You ain't heard nothing yet.
Turn around, little
bitch. What am I going to do?
Frankly, my dear,
I'm going to make him an offer.
You talking to me?
No! I am not entertained!
I don't know who you are.
Why so sick?
When I'm good, I'm very good.
Simple.
But when I'm bad, I'm better.
He's a liar!
Snap out of it!
If they call me Mr.
A boy's best friend is his mother.
You have no style.
You can bark all day, little dog.
Fasten your seatbelts. It's going to be a bumpy night.
Hello, and welcome back to the Tinsel Factory. My name is Caitlin, and I'm your host. Hope everybody had a great couple of weeks. I spent the last weekend hiding from the world like it was March of 2020 all over again. I absolutely loved, it turns out, not talking or going out so much, which I don't think was the lesson I should have taken from last weekend. But if I liked being around people regularly, I would have a co-host for this show. I will say, I did go to the office on Tuesday and I felt like super refreshed as well. People needing crap was less annoying than it had been for the last couple of weeks. So I think I just needed a people detox and I had a really great time drinking wine and watching movies. So everybody wins. This week on Movie Theater Movie Reviews, we've got Late Night with the Devil and Immaculate. A lot of horror movies out right now. Not complaining, just an observation. Late Night with the Devil is an elevation of the found footage film in that it takes place in real time as it recounts the footage of a quote-unquote infamous late night TV show episode from the 70s that went horrifically awry. So basically you're watching Late Night with Jimmy Fallon episode go absolutely batshit bananas. That's essentially what the setup of this is, but obviously it's not Jimmy Fallon, it's a made-up dude from the 70s. I went into this movie with no expectations and I really, really, really liked it. I don't want to say anything more about it because I think you should go in pretty blind. I thought that was the best way to go, but I do highly recommend it. Really enjoyed it. It was very fun and with an audience, but that's a horror movie for you. Then there was Immaculate. And I honestly couldn't tell if it was a good movie or if Sydney Sweeney, the lead, was just really trying. She's got consummate theater kid energy. Most of the movie is just really basic nun devil religion horror, but it is incredibly well acted. Even the supporting cast is very good. It's just very generic. And there's a lot of things that had a lot of people in the theater kind of awkwardly laughing because it did get a little ridiculous. And I don't know if it was the audience influencing me or if it was just like my bafflement with some of the direction choices that were made. I'm not sure. I honestly, it's been a while since I've seen a film and I'm like, I don't even know if I liked that or not. I genuinely am not sure. I definitely need to watch it again just to kind of, I need another look at it before I make a final decision. But it was very generic, but I think it was pretty well executed. But it's just like, it wasn't anything special. So yeah, I'll watch it again when it's on streaming and make a final verdict. My Criterion pick of the week is Spine number 89, which is Brian De Palma's Sisters. I just decided to go full horror this week. I have been meaning to watch this film for several years, and it turned out to be yet another that I can't believe I had not watched yet, because I'd actually been unknowingly viewing knockoffs of it for years. There's a lot of twisty tropes in here that, if they didn't originate with this film, they definitely were knocked off of this film. Sisters is a thriller involving two twins and their reporter neighbor who believes she witnessed one of the twins committing a murder. The reporter chases the story and gets way more than she could have ever bargained for. I forgot to write myself an opinion. I liked it. I've had a very relaxing couple of weeks off. But yeah, that's that. And now, new month, new theme. This month, we're looking at the life and times of the worst director that never lived, Alan Smithy. If you know, you know. And if you don't know, well, you're about to know. Just hold on. This week, the director's origins and his first film, Death of a Gunfighter. With that, let's take our places. It's showtime.
We don't have any law in this jerkwater town. He's the law.
Come get me, Frank.
I want to marry you.
After all these years, why are you just asking me today?
I tried my damnedest not to kill him.
Does it matter?
It matters that you believe
me. Isn't it more important that they believe you?
I don't care what they believe.
feels super weird being. I feel like I haven't done this in like 20 years. It's only been like 2 weeks. Okay. He made some of the arguably worst films ever made, but Alan Smithy has never spent a day on a film set or on this mortal coil. He's not real if you're not catching on to what I'm laying down. The pseudonym Alan Smithy was created in 1969 because of the film we're looking at today. Before this, the DGA, the Directors Guild of America, did not allow directors to be credited under a pseudonym. This was intended to prevent producers and studios from forcing them upon directors, as that would inhibit the development of the directors' resumes. But if a director decided they'd rather not have this film tied to their resume, then ultimately the DGA figured that would be fine. While the name Alan Smithy is often attributed to horrifically bad films, it actually didn't start out that way. The first director to use the credit was actually two directors. The first was Robert Totten, whose mainstream career started at Warner Brothers in the early 60s, thanks to his independent film The Quick and the Dead from 1961. Totten directed scores of television episodes, including for Gunsmoke, Mission Impossible, Bonanza, and Magnum P.I. In 1968, Totten was brought on board across the street at Universal to direct a Western for the studio, which would be called Death of a Gunfighter. The film takes place late in the cowboy era and heavily dealt with the end of the quote-unquote Wild West as quote-unquote modern civility reached the region thanks to the railroads. We talked a little bit about this a while back, like in January and February. Since this isn't a super well-known film and it's not the easiest to get your hands on, I had to order a DVD online like it was 2006 and I'm still waiting on it. So with all that in mind, for the first time, I figured I'd break down the plot for you guys. Assume that wouldn't be too much of an imposition. I don't spoil the ending, don't worry. So Death of a Gunfighter deals with a small-town marshal at the turn of the 19th century. He's old school, shoot first and ask questions later kind of guy, a method of quote unquote lawfulness that the townspeople of Cottonwood Springs, Texas now view as a relic. When Marshal Patch kills a drunk man in self-defense, the town council decides to try and force the marshal to retire in favor of a modern police force. The marshal refuses, reminding the citizens that when he took the job, the contract with the town said he got to have that job for as long as he wanted, and he still wanted that job. The marshal is also aware of everybody's dirty secrets, it should bear mentioning because he's cleaned up the messes, back before everyone else wanted modern civility to come to the Wild West. The council ultimately get the county sheriff, a former protege of the marshal and his friend, to try and get him out of town. The sheriff, surprise, surprise, opts not to do anything because it's his buddy. This leads to some of the more outspoken councilmen to consider having the marshal just murdered. Guess just didn't realize the irony of that. After a series of run-ins with the town folk, an ambush is formed to kill the marshal. Things get crazy, and the man sent to actually kill the marshal ends up killing himself. That man's son promises revenge after being encouraged by some of the councilmen to do so, as they saw this as an easy way to finally get rid of the marshal and keep their hands more or less clean. Fully aware he's probably going to get killed, but also for some reason refusing to get the hell out of Dodge, the marshal marries his longtime girlfriend Claire, the local brothel madam. The marriage occurs on the same day as the funeral of the man that the marshal killed that kicked this whole mess off. The dead man's son, the one who killed himself during the ambush, goes rogue and attempts to kill the marshal on his own, but is then mortally wounded by him instead. The marshal explains to the dying boy that his dead father had shot a man in the back many years ago and killed him. The marshal had covered it up because the murderer had agreed to raise the dead man's young son as his own. So basically, the marshal is telling this dying boy or young man that the man that he himself just died for killed his actual father. So that's the kind of secrets that the marshal has on all of these people. The marshal is then attacked by one of the instigators of the plot to kill him, a saloon owner. Marshal wounds, captures, and jails this man, but then insists on going back out after the council for what he feels certain will be his last stand. And then the end of the movie happens, which I won't spoil for you. Playing the marshal was Richard Widmark, an actor who had been typecast early in his career as either villainous or anti-hero roles in film noirs, but by like 1968-69, he had branched out into more heroic leading and supporting roles in westerns, mainstream dramas, and horror films. So this film was obviously just a mix of him with his new roles and a callback to the roles that had kind of made him famous because he's a little bit more ambiguous here, even though he is a lawman. The wedding of the marshal to his brothel-heading girlfriend is believed to actually be a first for Hollywood, not because of the cowboy and the brothel madam that's been done, but rather because the marshal is a Caucasian man and he marries the African-American Claire. And at no point in the film is this actually mentioned, which surprises a lot of film historians, because throughout the film, it's very well established that the townspeople are very openly racist. These same film historians believe that this is likely not mentioned because elements of this that were present in the original script were never actually shot. Overall, this film has been cited as fine, if forgettable. One critique I read of it is that it looks too much like a television show, which isn't surprising given that the first director, Totten, had spent most of his career in television. Totten's coverage, meaning what angles were shot within a scene, are said to be very indicative of the TV Western style of the time, which was not ideal. This led to creative differences between Totten and Widmark. And since Richard Widmark was one of the most powerful stars on the Universal lot at the time of the production, definitely more than some TV director, very likely going to be his way or the highway. Death of a Gunfighter entered pre-production in 1967 at Universal. It didn't start out as anything particularly special. It got the standard Universal mid-level budget Western development and budget allotments. This included the studio's desire to have it shot in Technicolor, feature a score from Oliver Nelson, and also to have a song called Sweet Apple Wine, which would be performed by Lena Horne. Fun fact, this film was also a return to the screen for Horne, whose last film had been 1956's Meet Me in Las Vegas. She had spent the last several years focusing on her nightclub act. She'd also been kind of blacklisted because she'd been a communist sympathizer or communist, depends on the source, but she had distanced herself from that movement by this time. It has been said that Widmark and Totten were having issues, creative issues mostly from the jump, though for the life of me, I couldn't really find any specifics as to what those were. It's just very much like they did not like what the other one was doing. By the time shooting started, it was clear that Totten had just given up trying to get Widmark to do what he wanted, and several of the performances in the film, including Horne's, are said to have suffered as a direct result of this. After 25 days of shooting, Widmark finally managed to get Totten taken off the film with only 9 days left. Brought in to replace him on Widmark's insistence was a seasoned film director named Don Siegel. Universal hoped that doing this would end the conflicts, bring the film in on budget, something that Siegel had a reputation for being quite good at. Don Siegel was born to a Jewish family in Chicago in 1912. He was educated at Cambridge, briefly tried acting, before ultimately ending up at Warner Brothers in the library where they keep the films and other related materials. Did I seriously just explain what a library is? I've been smooth-braining it for too many days. Or too many weeks, probably, at this point. Anyway, eventually, Siegel would go from film librarian to montage editor, where he worked on films like Casablanca and Yankee Doodle Dandy, which were both from 1942. Siegel's first directorial projects were the short films Star in the Night and Hitler Lives. Though he went uncredited for these, both won Academy Awards, and this success led to him being promoted to making feature-length films. The first was The Verdict from 1946, which was a period piece about Scotland Yard featuring the popular on-screen team of Sidney Greenstreet and Peter Lorre. Notable other early Siegel films include 1956's Invasion of the Body Snatchers and 1968's Coogan's Bluff. Siegel would go on after this, if the name is familiar, to direct several Clint Eastwood films. They were constant collaborators, including Dirty Harry and Escape from Alcatraz. By the time he was brought on to Death of a Gunfighter, though, he was already a pretty established film director, certainly more than Totten. It took Siegel about 10 seconds upon arriving on the Death of a Gunfighter set for him to realize that Richard Widmark was the one actually calling the shots. But he'd not been brought on to be the artiste of this picture. The execs at Universal had basically told him, for the love of God, don't reshoot anything if you don't have to, just get this film made under budget or on budget. This was early-ish into Universal being rebuilt by its new parent company, MCA, so every dollar had to count. Siegel, looking at the script, opted to take out some of the more nuanced elements of the script in favor of a more standard Western. Originally, this film was supposed to be a bit more noirish in tone, but Siegel figured if it was more like basic Western, it would get the film done in the way that Universal would be happy with. Siegel saw the film through to the end, including the post-production process that took nearly 2 years. When it came time for deciding who would get the credit for directing the picture, Siegel refused to take it, as Totten had been the one who'd done the majority of the on-set direction. In the end, though, what showed up on the screen was closer to 50-50 in terms of the shots. So half of it was Siegel, half of it was Totten. Totten also refused, or was blocked by Widmark, depending on the source, to let his name appear on the picture. With the film now basically orphaned, or at least abandoned, the DGA held a hearing, the outcome of which was that the final film did not represent either director's creative vision. Siegel had also shouted from the rooftops during this time about what Widmark had done, and the DGA decided it wouldn't be right to force either Totten or Siegel to put their name on this film. But a film has to have a director, so a name had to be christened. This name would soon become sort of a ripcord of sorts for any director who wanted his name removed from a picture. There were rules and guidelines. You couldn't just remove your name willy-nilly, but we'll get to that in a few weeks. Or eventually. I'm not sure when. The original proposal was to credit a fictional director by the name of Al Smith, but the name was deemed too generic and turned out was already well in use within the film industry. The last name was then changed to Smythe or Smythe, then to Smithy, which was thought to be different enough to avoid confusion with similar names, but without drawing attention to itself, so just as generic as they could get without it actually being somebody else's name. Death of a Gunfighter, when finished, was also just a super generic Western, just like the name of its newly invented director. But it was a generic Western that people more or less enjoyed. When the film released in May of 1969 at long last, critics praised it and its quote-unquote new director. The New York Times claimed that this hot new director was quote-unquote sharp, and famed critic Roger Ebert commented that the Smithy film, quote, unfolded naturally. With the positive reviews in, Siegel, knowing the secret, told several of the younger directors he knew to change their last names to Smithy in order to take credit for the film and therefore get work off the back of it, because he certainly wasn't going to. Whether any of them ever did, he did not know. Though some people did use the last name Smithy in light of this because some people obviously did hear about it. While the pseudonym Alan Smithy was made for Death of a Gunfighter, it was ultimately not the earliest Alan Smithy film ever made. That film is actually Fade In, which was made in 1968, but not released until 1973. Director Judd Taylor, the actual director, had paid Paramount $1,700 to have his name taken off of the film, as he felt that the other writers that the studio had brought on to work on the script had ruined it. The film did not get a theatrical treatment, but rather was released on television as a CBS late-night movie. Its star, a young Burt Reynolds, called it, quote, the best thing I've ever done. Wonder if his opinion changed about that later. Well, you'd be hard-pressed to find Death of a Gunfighter these days. I obviously couldn't find it from any reputable streaming site. It ended up being a modest hit for Universal. After this, Robert Totten would only direct two feature films, 1970's The Wild Country for Buena Vista, aka Disney, and 1979's independent film Pony Express Rider. Shockingly, he never went back to Universal. Totten did direct scores of television episodes as well after this, and when he died in 1995 at the age of 57, was still working actively in the industry. I mentioned Don Siegel's work after this earlier. He worked with Clint Eastwood extensively. Honestly, had a very long career at Universal because Clint was a Universal dude for quite a while. But like I said, he went on to direct extensively and passed away in 1991. Death of a Gunfighter was not mentioned, unsurprisingly, in either man's obituary. With a new name established, Alan Smithy became an insider secret, one that stayed more or less hidden for the next 30 years. Alan's next films would, unfortunately, pale in comparison from this debut.
Thank you.
shorter of an episode this week. There wasn't a lot out there about this one, but I felt like I had to start with this one and, you know, establish everything. And I didn't want to beef it up with any unnecessary stuff. So yeah, mean and lean this week. And that is also going to do it for this week. If there's anything you'd like me to cover in the future, please reach out on social media, where I also post photos for each episode. At Tinsel Factory Pod on Instagram, on Facebook at The Tinsel Factory, or you can always email me at tinselfactorypod@gmail.com. I've got a Letterboxd account which features my watch lists, film diary, and recommended viewing for this episode. You can check it out at the link in the show notes. I'm relying on word of mouth to get this podcast out there, so if you could please rate, review, and subscribe so that other people can find this podcast, that would be a huge help. In order to keep making the podcast, I've also set up a support page, the link of which you can find in the show notes. If you'd like to help out in any way, I'd very much appreciate it. D_Nat302, thank you very much for the nice review. I always get so excited when I find another Gary Oldman fan. I still need to watch his Apple TV series, though. I hear it's amazing. I've also got the Buy Me a Coffee, where you buy me a coffee. I just did plain old pour over because I had some beans I needed to get rid of because they're getting a little stale. I've also got merch. Check it out with the link in the show notes. Next week, we look at Alan Smithee's work on the film The Twilight Zone movie. That one's going to be a bummer, so prepare thyselves. Thanks again for listening, and until next time, that's a wrap. Thank you.